from the Ante Up headquarters in Tampa Bay, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now, here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's October 22nd, 2021. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the interwebs. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
You know, I'm struggling to find titles for our shows when we always lead off with the World Series of Poker.
Yeah, you know, that is what it is.
So. I don't want them to, you know, think, oh, it's just, that's a repeat or something, you know, because I'm always saying World Series of Poker update. So I'll have to come up with something a little catchy for the title.
You should do World Series updates through event whatever. And then that's different.
That's true. But if, like, the screen is too small and they can't see the rest of the writing and they don't get to the event, they might still. So I'm going to come up with something special, I think, this week. I don't know what's going to happen.
You know, I'm assuming people would want to hear World Series updates anyhow. So
you know what's really remarkable, too, is that like every week there's some really good stories.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's like every week there's something interesting, which is not what our show usually is. So.
All right. Well, we're more than a third way through this year's WSOP, and here are this week's updates. Laura Eisenberg won event 22, the $1,000 Women's Championship. They call it the Ladies' Championship, but I refuse to.
Very good. Women's. That's right. Very good.
Think about that. Anyhow, it was for her 16th World Series Poker Cash, and J.J. Liu made the final table.
Hey, before we go on, they said that she set some sort of world record, and I was too lazy to look it up. What was it? She's a record holder. Do you remember what that was?
I did not see that.
That was on one of the recaps. I'm like, world record holder and now gold bracelet winner or something. And I'm like, oh, what does that mean? But
that's not that. I'm a former world record holder.
That's true. That's true. You and half the city. Safety Harbor.
Anthony Zinno became this year's first two bracelet winner, taking down event 27, the $1,500 horse, for his fourth career bracelet. Chase Kornuth won event 29, the 10K short deck, for his third career bracelet. Phil Hellmuth won event 31, the $1,500 no limit deuce to seven, for his 16th career bracelet in his fourth final table of this year's series. In his victory interview, he conceded he went too far in his expletive-filled rant in a previous event. David Baker won event 34, the $1,500 limit deuce to seven low ball, for his third bracelet. Anthony Kautos.
I'm not helping you at all. It's the best part of the show.
Anthony K, who had career earnings of $5,000 and was playing in his first World Series of Poker, won event 35, the $500 freeze out. Andrew Friedman won event 36, the 10K dealer's choice, for an unprecedented third consecutive year and his fourth bracelet overall. He came back from a 4-1 chip deficit, heads up against Phil Hellmuth for the title. It was Hellmuth's fifth final table of the series, putting him atop the World Series Poker Player of the Year leaderboard. And the WSOP has added two flights to the main event as international travel restrictions have been eased.
Where do we start?
Yeah, wow. All right, well, let's talk about the big stuff. Obviously, Hellmuth, we all thought Hellmuth was going to get a bracelet at some point. He's been just playing lights-out poker and finally got it. And then a couple days later, the tweets were like, can this be happening again? And he really, Friedman had him like dead to rights there. And Hellmuth had Friedman dead to rights there. And then came back to keep him from his 17th bracelet. So that's clearly the story. And then to think that he had to get that fifth final table and the runner up to overtake Anthony Zinno as the player of the year. So I'm going to start with that. I mean, we have a lot to talk about with Hellmuth, though. But I do think it's funny, sad, obviously, in that way, but funny. That he sat there and berated Anthony Zinno for minutes and minutes and minutes about how horrible a player he is. And he had to come back and win a bracelet and a second, a runner-up, just to pass him on the leaderboard.
I know. It's so hilarious.
I mean, there's got to be some irony there, right?
Yeah. And the thing about what makes Phil Hellmuth so special, and you can interpret that any way you want, in his victory interview, he talks about, oh, yeah, I shouldn't have done what I did. And it's like, see, that's the difference between you and everybody else, is that we have that switch that says this is probably not right. And he's kind of has that mantra of, you know, do what you want first and ask for forgiveness later rather than just do the right thing. And, you know, regardless of his antics at the table, he's obviously the best poker player on the planet right now, regardless of cash game ability. I don't care. It's ridiculous. But, yeah. For him to just exudes irony with everything he does.
Yep.
The one thing I will say And again, you know, I know we just keep going back to this, but the man is 57 years old. Yep. And I don't know about you, but I'm in my 50s now. You're getting there. And it's like your brain does not work the way it did when you were way younger, even in your 30s or 40s. And so to keep that kind of mental stability and acuity, and just like that time I interviewed Doyle Brunson at Foxwoods, and he told me, he's like, you know, it's not easy to keep your mind sharp. At the age of 50, you start to deteriorate. There's no question about it. And this guy, 7 years into his 50s, is playing the best poker of his life. It's really remarkable, no matter how much you hate the guy or like the guy, whatever, you know, he's polarizing, obviously. But he is just remarkable right now for that someone that age. It's unbelievable. Unbelievable to me.
Yeah, I would say it's pretty much without question that this is a guy who takes his career seriously. And when COVID came and everything shut down, and I mean, you could probably still play online then, but he's not known as a particularly, I mean, one of the elite online players as far as I know. But he obviously took that time to hone his craft. You know, he didn't go to Hawaii with his girlfriend and skip off-season training camp with the Packers like some people do. he certainly had to be invested in this and just kept working at it. And I say that not just because of the success he's having, but the fact that it's in all of these mixed games.
I know. You know,
three games that was always his Achilles heel, even though people said he was actually better at those games than people thought. So that's my praise here for him. I mean, I think the reality that the obit when he dies is going to be one of the best poker players of all time and one of the worst poker ambassadors of all time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know he doesn't like being an ambassador, and that's fine. You know, he really kind of like personifies what poker is. And we all like to think that poker is a great game, and and we do a lot of good stuff with it. But at the end of the day, it is a tournament poker, at least, is a kill or be killed game, right? It's a singular one person Hunger Games, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's one winner in every tournament. You know, I mean, 10 to 15% cash as well too, but it one winner, right? So you can't always be too surprised when there's players that treat it like that on and off the felt, right? That he's just all he cares about is winning. Yeah. Doesn't care about the other stuff.
Yeah.
Now I guess to the extent that I'm wrong with that is, you know, he does have this brand. He's built this brand. He likes the attention. I think he would rather have the attention for his play than his antics, but That's you know, the bet he's made for himself.
Yeah,
so.
The choice he made, exactly. And there's a little part of him, obviously, I think, that does like being the ambassador. Like, you've witnessed firsthand when he's like the MC for a tournament, how gregarious he is and gracious he is and funny he is and everything. So I think when you get him away from the table, like they always talk about, and again, here we are talking about the same discussion about him, but I think there is a little part of him that says, if I had the chance to do it all over again, I probably would be more gregarious or whatever. And, you know, I would take what I've learned now and apply it, but he just can't help himself sometimes. And I think it's because of the pressure he puts on himself.
And that's what I don't get right now. I mean, he's been playing phenomenally this series is what we've been saying, right?
Yeah.
I just don't know. I mean, this was his year to really wash away that stereotype of him, right? Whether he built it himself, which I think we all think he did, honed it himself. But if he really, really wanted to get past it, this was his year because he was just playing lights out. He was doing well in these games that people said he doesn't know how to play. And if he would just do that, I mean, imagine the conversations we'd be having with him right now if he didn't have that rant.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, his, you know, I'm rewatching West Wing for the 19th time, so his popularity would be through the roof, but they're not, right?
Yeah.
You know, he had a chance to get out of this, and he didn't. And again, I still conceived it watching that the video that whole rant thing was contrived in some way or, you know, tweaked by him to make it worse than it was. It just didn't seem real to me. So it's not even like he wasn't trying. I think, you know, he was still trying to be the bad boy and then also show people he could play. So,
yeah.
Really weird, but enough about him. Let's talk about Andrew Friedman. This is really amazing to win the same event three times.
You don't want this guy in your home game.
Right? It's still a choice too, right? Which arguably could be one of the most difficult because there's so many games that you have to know. And then two, there's a game within a game, right? And you know what game do you pick when it's your turn?
Yep.
Based on your opponents and what you think your strongest at and what they're weakest at.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, has that ever even happened, that someone's won the same event three times in a row? It's the first time, right? That's why we use the word unprecedented. Okay, so
yeah, there's been a couple back-to-back winners before, but never a back-to-back-to-back winner. This is the first.
It's remarkable. And, of course, Helmut's there at the end with him playing in a mixed game. You know. But one thing I want to say, too, that I think we answered one of our questions from earlier in the series, or the preview of the series, was we thought, and I thought, and you did too, I think, that the pros were going to dominate because there weren't going to be a lot of big fields, and they had been waiting so long to play, and they weren't going to pass up any events this time around because they didn't get to play last time around. So every single result, it seems like, is winning, being won by a pro or runner-up by a, and most of them are pretty popular pros. Like, I'm not just because you're listing them every week for us for the highlights. I mean, a lot of these people who are winning these events are people that even I've heard of, and I've stopped paying attention a long time ago. So I think we got our answer that smaller fields means professional victories, I think.
Yeah, and it's the larger fields that the amateurs are winning. So, I mean, I don't obviously give an update on every event. There's not a compelling story there. I'm not going to waste our time on the show with it. So a lot of those are, you know, random people that have get their first cast, their first bracelet or whatever like that. So, but yeah, definitely in the 10K buy-ins, these 5K buy-ins, it's definitely career pros that are dominating.
But even like, look at the list today. Anthony Zinno, 1500. That's what my event was, right? Yep. Phil Hellmuth, 1500. That was my event. Dave Baker, 1500. That was my event. Until you get to Friedman with the 10K, these guys are winning the smaller events as well. I think the pros are enjoying this kind of a field and they're just exploiting it. It's great. Well, I mean, it's not great, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, certainly Hellmuth and Zinno are enjoying it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And then, I'm not going to say that this kind of messes up our predictions because we were both at right around 6,000, right?
Yep.
For the main event. But adding two flights certainly helps, I would think.
Yeah.
And, of course, we didn't know going into that travel restrictions were going to be eased. And we don't know, because that they're eased, that means more people are going to come. You still don't know, right? You know.
Yep.
So we'll see. But it's a good development for the World Series that they're able to add two flights. Particularly, I mean, because one of the storylines this entire series has been the lack of dealers and the lack of...
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess they could be reckless in adding two flights. I don't think they are. So I don't believe they're adding them because they feel like they can handle that additional field. I hope I'm right with that. So if that's the case, then that's a good story as well, too. So,
yeah.
And I always like these stories, these guys that have never really won anything, and hey, I'm gonna go to the World Series and then turn out and win a bracelet, right?
Yeah, it's insane.
Well, that's a great story. You know, we've all wanted to be that person, right? And then, you know, my dream ended in level 4, I think. You at least made the dinner break, so but career earnings of 5K, I have more than career earnings in 5K. I mean, not a lot, but I do have more than 5K.
I do not. I don't even have that much on Hendon Mob. I stopped playing tournaments early in my career, but I don't even have that much. I mean, I don't even, like, it sounds like I'm a good player, but you know what I mean? I'm not even close to that. So that's, for me, he's a pro. I mean, right? But it is a remarkable story. I always love hearing those. I hate hearing it, like, when the guy says, oh, I never played the lottery, first time, and he wins $1 million. Then I'm, like, pissed off. But for something like this, I'm really happy for the guy. I mean, obviously, he could be playing a lot of poker. That's tournament poker. But it could be just like, you know, local room $50, $100 buy-in ones that aren't going to Hendon Mob. But even so, yeah, it's really impressive. Of course, it is a $500 freeze out.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I mean, I really do appreciate the World Series having these type of events, right? So, one, the buy-in is low. I mean, we didn't have a $500 event scheduled. We went out there, right? So mine was $1,000. I think yours was
$1,500.
Yep. That was a big deal for me. I mean, $500, I can do that any day. Now, not that big a deal, and the fact that it's a freeze out, so you really curb the pros' advantage.
Yeah.
They only have one bullet, and you know, knock Phil Hellmuth out, then you don't have to worry about him buying back in
and yelling at you.
Yeah, with the way he's running this year, so
right.
So that does help. So I mean, it does make for good stories like this as well too. So I will give the WSOP credit for that.
That was a really good week of poker right there. I think that was a lot of interesting storylines. And the one thing I know we're moving on here, but the one thing I don't agree with is short deck being a bracelet. I'm sorry, I just don't.
Here's the thing: I still haven't played short deck. I want to because I want to see how it plays. But it's become popular and it's another variation. So, and hey, you know, if somebody put $10,000 down to play without all the cards in the deck, right, that's fine. Whatever.
I don't know, but we used to pride ourselves, like at our home game, to be like, you can only play World Series games in our, you know, that kind of thing because they're legitimate games. But there's just something that tells me that, you know, removing cards from the deck, it's not legitimate. It's like saying, okay, you can't throw a curveball in baseball. Well, you win the short deck World Series, you know, of poker or of baseball. You know what I mean? It's just weird. You're eliminating the cards. It's one thing if you add a joker, I guess, and even that seems a little dirty to me, too. I want to take a shower if I'm playing that game. But I don't know. There's something about giving a bracelet away for short deck.
I mean, it's different. Short deck for me is different than follow the queen or night baseball or any of that crazy stuff I played back when I used to play dimes and quarters with. In college, right? So, I mean, short deck is now being played everywhere, I think. So,
yeah, I guess.
It's just new. So,
like the Chinese poker, how they did that for 1 year, and then they got rid of that, too, because that died out.
That turned out to be a fad. Maybe short deck will be a fad as well, too. But,
I think it will be.
Hey, you know,
I don't want
to sit on my mantle. And
I don't want to. I'm telling you, I don't want to get you on another Survivor rant, so I'm glad to move on now if you want.
Oh, trust me, I was on a rant with David Bloomberg last night.
I believe it.
His last episode. I'm like,
See, I already did it. The only thing
they could have, they forgot to do was have Fonzie out there jumping a shark. That's all they
could. Oh, man. I totally agree with you now. I think I'm on the Team Scott now. It's driving me crazy, this show. But
he's holding talk.
I don't want to talk about it anymore. Let's move on to the Hall of Fame.
All right, this year's Poker Hall of Fame nominees have been announced. Voting is done by all current Hall of Famers who are given 10 points to distribute however they wish. Just one nominee will be inducted in November. Here are the nominees: Antonio Esfandiari, Ted Forrest, Chris Ferguson, Bertrand Elke Grospelier, Mike Matisau, Ali Alezra, Michael Mizrachi, Lane Flack, Matt Savage, and Isa Scheinberg. Flack, Mizrachi, and Grospelier are first-time nominees, replacing Patrick Antonius. The combo of Lon McCarron, Norman Chad, and Huck Seed from last year's list. Seed was the lone inductee last year.
Okay, so this is like deja vu ante up today. I mean, this is ridiculous. One person gets in.
So here's the thing, and I put that on the show notes, and I just want to clarify. I could not confirm with the World Series that only one person is getting in. The release did not say that.
Someone said, I've seen it in a few stories now.
That, other stories I've seen have said that, so I just don't know. I probably shouldn't have put this in the notes just because I wasn't sure. So I don't know if people are just assuming it's going to be one again, but it was really interesting to me that the release did not mention how many were going to get in. It just didn't, and I'd read it three times, I think. So I don't know, but yeah, you're right. Go ahead. I assume it's one, and that is ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. It's going to be just one, probably. And if it is, I mean, these poor guys—not poor guys, because they're, you know, poker players who are living the life. But I mean, every single person on this list is a Hall of Famer. I mean, every single one of them. And how do you not put in Lane Flack? He was probably the greatest poker player of all time in the 2000s, and now he's gone. There's no way he's not getting in. If he doesn't get in, something is, you know, it's going to tug at their hearts or whatever it's going to be, but he's probably going to get in. And so now all these other guys have no chance of getting in this year because if Lane was still alive, they probably wouldn't have been voting on him this year, or they might have said, okay, we'll give him his time. But because he's gone, you know, I think he's going in. He deserves to be in more than most of these people, if not all of them. But it's like, one person, seriously? I mean, are you thinking you're going to run out of poker players? It doesn't make any sense. It's one thing like baseball where it's difficult to find a person who checks all the boxes in baseball to get into the hall every year effectively. Where this is a piece of cake. You know, you've got, what, 10 guys, 10 people there at least, 11? It's like, to put in 10% of your nominees every year, I mean, it's ridiculous. I'm sorry, it's just absolutely ridiculous. Mizrachi, shoo-in, right? I feel bad for, you know, Antonio Sfondiari, shoo-in. Ted Forrest should be in already. He's been on this list forever. You know, Ferguson's got the political problems there, I think, you know, the... But, you know, Grospelier, for a time there, he was phenomenal. I haven't heard his name lights in ages, out. But...
Lights out.
But yep. He was lights out. So, I mean, you know, Mattisau, of course. So it's ridiculous that they're going to pull one name out of this. And it's, I think it's going to be Flack. Deservedly so. And
certainly would be the odds-on favorite. Yeah. And again, I'm going to say the biggest problem with the one nominee, if it is it, and even two when they did two, is that the builders, they call them, which in this list is Matt Savage and Isaiah Scheinberg, who, right. You know, they're players, but they're not pro-level players,
right.
On here because of their contributions in other way in building the game. I can't see a path forward for those folks. I mean, when you're allowing one person in, how do you rise above these other eight players who have done just phenomenal things on the felt, right?
Right.
And I think that's unfair because, I mean, Matt Savage deserves to be in there. I mean, how do you say Isaac Scheinberg, who created the biggest online poker company in the world, doesn't at least merit mention, right? So, but I just don't see a path forward for him. And I'm not surprised that Lon McCarron and Norman Chad fell off. I mean, again, I'm a big fan of both of them, but that little combo thing was a little kind of gimmicky for me.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But even if it's not, though, I mean, again, they're in the same boat. They're in the builder part, right? So... It's going to be tough, I think, for those folks.
I think that's a fantastic point that you made, because every year more names are going to get added to this list or more people. And when you start looking at the results just that you posted today alone, look at some of these names. These guys are going to be Hall of Fame. I mean, Dave Baker, you know, Anthony Zinno.
Yep.
I mean, these guys are going to – obviously every year, every time there's another World Series or a whole World Poker Tour or whatever you want to call it, every time these events are completed, more resumes get improved, and there's going to be more and more names added to these lists. And eventually, like, how does Patrick Antonius? I mean, okay, so he doesn't have a lot of titles. You know what I mean? When you think of poker titles, you don't think of Patrick Antonius. You think of cash game, really. You think of all the times you were impressed by how he played on TV and stuff when they had those cash game shows. But okay, so I can see him coming off the list, but. I can't see him getting back on the list if every year Dave Baker wins another bracelet. He's got three already. Zeno's got, what, four? I mean, these guys are going to start working their names up. You've got to start letting multiple people. And it's not like it's a building where you can't fit all these people into the building. It's a list. It's ridiculous. And we have the same conversation every year because it deserves to be said. Until somebody does something about it, you can't give up on this fight. It's ridiculous, one person at a time. At least two or three. You know,
only I believe 35 living Hall of Famers now. I believe that's the number, right?
Yeah.
So it's an extremely what's the word I'm looking for? Premium list, exclusive premium. List, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, if that's what you're going for, great, and that just makes the honor that much bigger, I guess. But and you know, I mean, if you're letting four or five in every year, I guess now we'd be having the conversation about bracelets of the World Series, right? If there's too many and if it's watering it down. So, but there's got to be somewhere in between, I think. And again, we say this every year too, but I'm like the baseball voting system is the best, I think. You know, you make it on 75% and you're in. If you fall behind that, then you fall off. There's no just 10 on the list every year. Some year it might be 30, some year it might be 15. It just depends. It's just a better system, I think. But
I agree. A percentage is the best way to go. Obviously, if that many people want you in, you deserve to be in. And the other thing too is that if you're leaving it up just to the people who are in the hall, it's not right. Just because you were able to play poker well doesn't mean that you should be analyzing other people's careers and what they've done. Because you know, a lot of these Hall of Famers that are in there from the old school don't put any weight on poker tournaments. You know, they think poker tournaments are just a game. You know, they don't think of it as a skill or whatever. I mean, they think it's a different set of skills that they don't really put any weight on. And so if you don't leave it up to someone who's like a disinterested third party who knows about the entire gamut of poker, from cash games to history to whatever, which is usually the media. I hate to admit it because we're in the media, but you know, I'm not voting, but if I was voting, I would take it very seriously and I would do all the research and I would know all the backgrounds of all these guys and do some talking to players who play with them in cash games or whatever the situation is. But to just say, oh, you're a living Hall of Famer, you get to put these guys in the Hall. Yeah, it's a great honor once you say, oh, I was in the Hall because Doyle Brunson and, you know, whatever, thought I was good enough to be in. It's an honor, but it's just, it's a screwed up system. And the fact that there's no building with busts and all that, and they got to worry about room or, you know, the whole induction ceremony where, you know, it's just going to be a party at the end of the World Series or whatever anyway, I just don't get it. To me, they're trying to make it this sort of premium, exclusive, respectful thing, and it ends up, for me, as a fan of poker and as a member of the poker community, ends up being sort of an insult, and I just don't get it. I hope Lane gets in. He deserves it, and I'll be sad if he doesn't get in. It will make zero sense to me, but I'm really bummed for the rest of them if they don't because of that, too. I think Matt Savage should have been in a long time ago. I think Mizrahi, now that he's eligible, he should be in on the first ballot. You know, I don't know about Grosbelier overall. I mean, he was a great tournament player. I don't know what he is like at the cash games. And obviously, if you're a good poker player, you obviously can play. But Antonio, come on. That guy won that massive million, and he's great at everything he does. He's won them all, from WPT to bracelets, and he's phenomenal. He's been phenomenal for the game itself, for like what he does on his analysis on TV and stuff. I mean, how do these guys, to deny them, it's just ridiculous, and it's just a list. So I think we've gone on and on enough about it, but I just can't get over it.
The last thing I'll add, just because of Helmy's blow up this year, is one of the interesting things about Poker Hall of Fame versus the other ones is that age 40 eligibility. You know, yeah. Once you turn 40, then you get in. Whereas in baseball and football, it's after you retire, there's a certain amount of time. Now, you can't do that in poker because no one really retires from poker.
Right.
So I get that, but I'm just curious whether if there was a system like that, how different the Hall would be. Because, I mean, would you go back and look at Helmuth now and say, hey, he was a great player, but he did all this crud that tarnished the game.
Yeah.
Does he not get in now? But he's already in, right? So, and it kind of allows, I think, for players in baseball and football that want to get in, and they kind of know that character counts now, right? I mean, there's a reason Pete Rose, one of the best baseball players in the world, is not in the Hall of Fame. So I think that lets players know, hey, I got to conduct – if I want to be in the Hall of Fame, I need to conduct myself in a proper way until I get in. And then once you get in, you can do whatever you want, obviously.
Right, right.
But, you know, and some might not do it. I mean, they look at Curt Schilling. He doesn't care, you know. He just does what he wants to do, and he's never going to get in because of it. So it is kind of interesting that, you know, the criteria as well, too. But
I tell you, you bummed me out, though, when you brought up that 40 thing, because that means that Grosbelier is 40. And I remember him being a kid. I just feel so freaking old now when you say that Grosbelier is in his 40s. That's killing me. All right, go ahead. Go on with your thing here you want to do here. I don't know what this is going to be, but.
All right, just have a little fun here. So I was flipping channels last week, and I came across Silver Spoons, and there was the pilot, and I don't even know what channel it was on, Great American Country or something. I don't even know what that channel is, but I loved Silver Spoons growing up, and I imagine most of our listeners are the same age that they probably watch this too, but Ricky Schroeder's first big break as this 12-year-old kid, and I was 10 when it started too, so it was perfect, and you know, his dad had this big huge mansion with the video games. I mean, it was like the perfect show in the 80s for us, right? Because every kid wanted to live at that place.
But. Right.
So anyhow, so I started watching it, and I loved it. It was great. You know, in the third episode, Mr. T has a cameo. In the fourth episode, Gary Coleman has a cameo as Arnold Jackson. I was like, oh, my gosh, how do I see all this stuff, right? But yeah, I got sucked in. So then we get to episode 5, and I was going to turn it off because I watched 4, and I'm like, all right, I think I've seen enough. I can move on to look more you know, adult stuff. but then I saw the beginning of episode 5, Ricky, his dad, and his dad's lawyer are playing poker. And I'm like, all right, I got to watch this. This is a sign, right? And they're playing for M&Ms. And
because Skittles weren't invented yet. That's why.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there might have been some Reese's pieces that. a couple things I'll just mention. One, the good, they were playing 7-card stud. Now, I mean, again, now this is 82.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Hold'em was around then, but it wasn't as popular as it is now. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that they're playing stud. But it was just nice to see a TV representation of poker that wasn't Hold'em.
Right.
Now, unfortunately, there's only one down card, and the dad called Ricky's river bet with 3 queens, and Ricky showing a possible straight flush. Come on. That's all. And then I couldn't help but notice that Ricky didn't burn when he was dealing, which, you know.
Everybody knows you'd burn, right?
It was like Frank Toscano was dealing, so, you know.
Well, first, I'll take offense at you saying that Silver Spoons was his first big break, because if you didn't see The Champ, then you are missing out.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about
The Champ. He was the most remarkable child actor on the planet after that movie. I mean, you watch that movie, you literally will cry buckets, and this kid was phenomenal. But okay, get past that. So did they say it was seven card stud?
No.
So if they didn't say it, then they were playing six card stud, and screw you.
It could have been six card stud. You're correct. Yes.
Right. So there you go.
Yeah, maybe I got too poker snobbiest there. But.
But that's that. I used to love that show. I don't know why. And that's where Jason Bateman was like. That's where he got his first break.
He was fantastic. Yeah. Sitting there watching him, he doesn't even look like him at all. I mean, Ricky Schroeder looks like Ricky Schroeder, but Jason Bateman does not look like him at all. And then there was a couple other people on there, and I'm like, oh my god, I can't remember these people. This is their big break. And then you fall down a rabbit hole where they all are now. And Aaron Gray, his secretary, who we were all in love with then, you know, 71 years old now.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was 82. It's pretty crazy to think back then. Wow. Jeez,
crazy. Okay. Annie Updates. Papes, the Annie Up Fans free online tournament series on PokerStars Play Money site, is available everywhere. Details how to join can be found at bit.ly/PAIPS. Games are on the 6th, 16th, and 26th of every month, and rotate disciplines with a main tournament followed by a second chance event. PokerStars lets you claim 15,000 free chips every 4 hours. Join the Annie Up Fans group Facebook page and post within the group to get feedback on hands. Ask call to floor questions or just discuss anything poker. Check out our 11 vintage Annie Up logo designs on merchandise at annieupmagazine.com/shop. You can buy t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, phone and laptop cases, coffee and drink mugs, and much more with your choice of Annie Up Magazine, Annie Up PokerCast, or Annie Up Pokotour logos. If you have a hand of the week, listener spotlight, or call the floor submission, email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com or post in the Annie Up Fans group on Facebook. Okay, we got a listener spotlight. Each week we spotlight a listener who emails us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com. If they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with call the floor and hand of the week, we send them something cool. This week's prize is a set up of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Annie Up Poker Cruises, available at classicplayingcards.com. This is Corey Kessler, and I think we're going to read the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk about it. Okay. Yep. So he says, at a recent family reunion where we were trying to teach Hold'em to several people who had very little poker background, I think we landed on a great training wheels version of the game. Start at the flop. You still start a hand by posting blinds and dealing the hole cards, but you also go ahead and show the flop before any action starts. The purposes of teaching this has number of advantages. One, it drastically reduces the complexity of what players have to take in and the interferences they have to make, allowing them to get a basic lay of the land before they enter the cave of shadows that is pre-flop play. In a time when players still are learning to identify made hands, they have an actual hand of five cards. For teaching purposes, we're giving them a chance to play out important scenarios of seeing a hand improve or watching an opponent suck out. Three, learning these post-flop dynamics gives players insights into the principles that should guide their decisions. Regardless of whether you play the cards or the player, you need to be able to read the board to do a good job. Learners need to have a good sense of how hands play out if we're going to expect them to make good decisions earlier on. Four, it's far easier to teach basic lessons about pot odds when you have only the turn and river left to come. And then five, after players have a basic idea of post-flop play, I feel like it should be much easier to teach them about pre-flop play. If we start them off by participating in a lot of flops, they can use their own experiences to judge the quality of their hole cards rather than just a set of seemingly arbitrary guidelines. He says, I have taught chess to high schoolers in the past, and I found it very useful to teach them about how to win in the end game early on. That way, after they learned how to use certain advantages to close out the game, they knew what they wanted to accomplish earlier in the game. I see this as being very similar. So, Scott, I have a very specific point of view that I want to use, but I think you might want to start on this. I'm not sure. Because you might agree with him, and then I can rip you apart. But.
No, I do agree with him. I think it's a fantastic way of getting people engaged in it before they get bored. And the one thing I told him that I liked about it is that when somebody's teaching me something new, I get super frustrated if I don't know what the end goal is. Because when you're telling, hey, you need to do this or need to do that, I naturally have questions as to why. Why would I need to do that? That doesn't make any sense. But if I know the end goal, then it starts to help out a little bit. So I'm a big fan of myself learning that way. So I kind of like what he's doing here. Now, the caution I gave him is that you do need to be very clear with folks when you're starting out with a flop there that that's not how the game is played. And at some point, they need to readjust their heads to the fact that there's a very important round that happens before you see any cards.
Is that all you got?
That's all I got. So.
Well, I gave this some serious thought. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to convey that in the time constraints we have here. But some of the things that I don't like about it are, one, to get to your point about the end part of it, you want to know the goal. You can't play poker until you know what beats what. So once you know what beats what, then the end goal is obvious. And I don't think you need to have that flop. I think what beats what is so vital. It was so vital that you and I came up with a cheat sheet that had every single possible hand on it when we were teaching Poker 101 for Derby Lane and for our cruises. So the end game is obvious. If you don't know what beats what, you should not be sitting down at the table anyway. So he had mentioned in it that they had very little poker background. So if they didn't know what beats what, now giving them five cards to figure out what beats what, it's, to me, you're just throwing too much at them. If they've tackled what beats what.
Say that he didn't do that, though. I would assume that he started out with what beats what. I mean,
right. So if he does know that, then there is no worry of the end game or the goal, because we know what the end game or the goal is. It's to make one of those hands if you can, or at least to know the value of that hand. You will know the value of that hand. The thing that bothers me about the putting out the flop already, this will, in my mind, inherently make every player playing this game too loose. Because they're going to see, oh, look how awesome this hand is now. And they're going to think any two cards will play. Now you're going to have to relearn the game as, oh, I need to tighten up and learn. For instance, what you and I used to teach was, you know, blackjack hands, fit or fold, and all that stuff where, you know, if the hand doesn't fit, you fold it. Blackjack hands are good hands to start with, and then you work your way down to other hands once you get a little more comfortable. For me to now just take any two cards every time and get to see five cards and know I'm getting two more, it's a halfway between hold'em and stud. Whereas stud, you get three cards to start, so you're almost there. Imagine playing stud with five cards to start, where you get two down and three up. You know, you would play every hand to the end almost, because you've already gotten to five for free. It's going to make you a looser player, and that is not the way you learn poker to start. You learn ABCs, tight is right, you know, TAG. You know, you want to have something to hold on to. The reason why I got pretty decent at stud eight when I finally embraced mixed games was because the platinum rule of young Brunson was, hey, you know what? The platinum rule is to scoop and to always start out trying to go low. And if you don't start out to go low and try to scoop, then you're already playing for only half the pot no matter which way you go, and you're making a mistake. And so it was something I can cling to, and then I learned the nuances of the game. For me to not be able to see all five cards at first like that, that's going to just... And when you talk about odds and pot odds and all that stuff, people aren't looking at pot odds pre-flop. And people aren't really even looking at odds until after the flop anyway. So why does it make it simpler to show them five cards? Okay, you know the odds of the last two street, but you're not really looking at pot odds pre-flop, really. It's not that vital to learning hold'em in the beginning of this game. I just think he talks about the post-flop dynamics. I understand that, but that's more of the nuances of the game. It's not actually learning the game itself. I feel like you're going to regret it. It's kind of like remember when we watched Neuronders and there's a scene where Kanish says to Mike, you know, I wrote the books from my bad beat so you wouldn't have to. It's some sort of like that. It's the same thing here. If they're going to not know how to play from the beginning, they're going to develop all these poor habits from a post-flop analysis and then have to go back and relearn everything. And then it's like, well, I used to make straights all the time. Now I don't. Well, because you're not, you know what I mean? It's because you're not playing those cards anymore. You're playing a more powerful game by playing the right cards and position and all that. To me, I just feel like this will only produce loose, I don't want to say uneducated players because this is for fun. So, but I'm saying it would only produce loose players that will have a problem having to go back and relearn the thing. You know, when you grow up as a, you know, as somebody who learns how to do something very well, but you never had any formal training, and then you're like, well, I'm really good at this. Maybe I should get really good at it and do it professionally or something. You're going to find out all the mistakes that you made growing up, and you're going to have to relearn them properly. And muscle memory is very difficult to overcome. But if you learned it right the first time, then you don't have to worry about relearning that. It's just going to make it twice as hard for them to have to go backwards in time. That's how I felt about it. I was going to email them, and I said, no, I'll just wait for the show. But I felt like it seems like it made it more fun for the family get-together because then they got to, like, see more hands and more streets and all that stuff. But for learning purposes, I would disagree with this. This is just my side.
I'm actually surprised you didn't have anything to say about this.
I know, and I'm thinking this show is going to be really long. Scott's got to squeeze in this silver spoons thing, and I got a lot to say about how to teach Hold'em, you know. But, I mean, I can kind of understand his end game stuff with the chess. That mean, I've played chess before, you know, kind of played seriously, but I sucked at it. But for this, I just feel like it's such a simple thing. It's not that hard to figure out the two cards preflop. It's such a simple thing. And if you're playing it properly, then you're going to play the right amount of hands too. So you've already gotten past the whole, am I going to be a loose or a tight, too tight player and all that. I mean, the fit or fold, that kind of stuff that we used to profess. I mean, to me, it's only one step earlier. We're talking about one step. So why not just teach that step? It's really not that many steps to the flop. It's one step. You know, you're still going to teach them the betting when it goes around with all five cards. So why not just teach them with two cards and say to them, hey, if it makes a good blackjack hand, play it. Or if it's a pair, play it. Other than that, fold the cards. And that's all there is to it, to start to learn how to play the game. And then when the flop comes, it's just one more betting round. It's just one more step. And you don't really deal with odds really that often, at least at a full table when you're first starting a tournament or a cash game. So I don't know. To me, I just felt like he had a lot of great points, but I just felt like it's just one more step. And that's why I disagreed with it.
Wow. Okay. So I don't necessarily disagree. I think a couple of things here. One, it's all in the teaching style, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it depends. I mean, I don't know how long he keeps teaching with the flop before he finally lets him in on that, you know, you don't start with the flop. And again, I assume he probably tells him from the very beginning, yeah, this is not how it starts, but so it's a matter of whether the students actually remember that or how well they remember that, right?
Right.
I guess what I like about it is that I go back to, like, our early home games when we had a lot of, like, people had no idea what they're doing, right? Not later on when we all are know every game inside out, right?
Right.
And one of the things that I'll always remember is that people, when they have a pocket pair, they think it's gold.
Yeah.
And so I remember his hand with one of the guys that he went all the way to the river with a pair of fours in his hand when there were five cards on the board higher,
yeah,
right? Yeah. Any other card, they had to beat, not counting the flushes and straights that might have been possible at the time. And he was just so surprised that his hand lost because that wired pair he thought was so much stronger than it really was. So where I think the benefit of showing the flop right away is, hey, your cards might look really good before the flop comes out. But remember, see what the flop does to the dynamic of the game. I think that actually makes you tighter than looser. But
see, now that's the exact opposite. I see that's so funny you brought that up. I feel like that would discourage people. I mean, to me, the whole reason for learning preflop play is to know that that pair is valuable if you do the proper thing right now, which is to raise and get people out and minimize the field. If you get a pocket pair of eights and then you see a flop every single time of king, six, nine, you're never going to play pocket eights ever again as a player, or you're going to have to totally relearn it again.
And we went back to Poker 101. That was one of the things that we always did was, hey, I'm going to teach you the basics of the game. And when you watch me play in the cruise later on, and I'm talking more about my Omaha classes.
Yeah, yeah.
over 1-1, but I'm like, when you see me play Omaha at the cash table later on, you're going to see me do things that I'm telling you not to do. And the reason I'm doing them is because I've been playing this game a long time and I know how to do those things now, right?
Right.
But you start out, you don't want to overload students with a bunch of that kind of stuff. It's like baseball. You want to teach them the fundamentals. They, you know, put your knee down so the ball doesn't go on your legs, Tanner Boyle, right? So, and once you get the fundamentals, then you can teach the finer aspects and the where you can break the fundamentals, where it's positive EV to break the fundamentals. So I really think when I'm teaching poker 101, I just want them to play a good, solid game. They're not going to win a lot because if you play against better players, they're going to outplay you because they know how to manipulate the fundamentals, but they're not going to lose a lot either. So I would rather, and I think if I did anything, you know, teach me how to, ride a bull. I would want to be taught to do it properly, even to not optimally, right? I guess.
Yeah, well, that's why when you pick up every single fundamental poker book, they start with starting hands. There's a reason for it, because that's the fundamental of poker, is knowing what to play, not seeing the potential of playing. So the minute you throw in all five cards to them, you know, that's why when everybody plays draw, when they first learn how to play poker as a kid, they play draw poker, five cards, because they want to see as many cards as possible, and they want to have the possibilities, which is why everyone struggles to play Omaha the first time they play it after they've learned Hold'em, because they see all these possibilities. They don't realize you got to be even tighter with Omaha than you do with Hold'em. And so, to me, to show them five cards right away, you're just getting away from the fundamentals, and you're only going to have to go back to the fundamentals to reteach it. And to me, that's a problem.
Would it be different if he is putting out 10 flops?
So like five, so as if you're playing seven card stud, but everyone's on Fifth Street on their own hand.
No, like 10 different flops. So I think the teaching moment would be, hey, look at your hand. Here are, and because one flop is, it's an anecdote, right? But 10 flops, now you have a more data points, right? So I think that might help if I'm sitting there pocket fours to look at that board now and see 10 different boards and how many times my hand is good on any of those. Almost never, right?
Yeah, well, that's a lot of flops. So I did a different version of that when I was teaching. I would give someone two cards, and then I would deal out 18 cards face up, and say, "You see all these cards? These are all the potential cards that are out there in your opponent's hands right now. Yep. Let's see if I can deal a flop, turn, and river with any potential of these cards that can beat whatever you're holding in your hand." And every single time, the hand lost. So to me, I conveyed it that way. I would say, there are all these cards out there, and your two cards better be really good to beat all of those cards. And this is why you raise and get them out if you have a good hand, because there's a potential, 18 cards out there. What's going to win? 18 versus 2? 18 versus 2 is always going to win. And so you have to shrink it down. And it's the same thing with the flops. Your way was putting out 10 flops. Okay, your hand is doing well here. But now let's deal out 18 other cards to the side of it and see if we can still find a hand that beats your hand. And 9 out of 10, you're going to probably lose. So I just think it's I never want to go back. It's kind of like the pet peeve I used to have when we would put out the magazine and we'd have the whole issue done. And at the last minute, something would cancel and we'd have to redo stuff. And it just always bothered me when we had to redo things. You know, it's like I wasted that moment of my life and I only have one life to live. Same thing with this. If I have to learn how to play a game, and then you're going to say, April Fools, now we have to go back in time and teach you the proper way to do this, and everything you just learned is really kind of useless because, you learned what five cards can do, but you didn't really learn how to play the game. You just learned, the elements or something. I don't know. But it just, to me, it seemed like, and I don't know, we're talking probably too much. We could have done a whole show on this one topic, really. We still have O'Malley's move and hand of the week. So, Corey, I love the way you think, and I love that you're trying to make it easier for people. And if it works out for our listeners where they want to try it that way, I totally applaud it. But for me, I would just think learning about two cards and the right way to start is a lot easier than backtracking.
Oh, good luck, Corey.
Hey, we get to complete O'Malley's move today. So we're going to listen to part one right now to refresh our memories, and we'll see you on the other side.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week we are playing in a $2, $5, No Limit Hold'em casino cash game. This is a typical 2-5 game with a lot of players here who think they are better than they are. The game is 8-handed. The blinds post, the under-the-gun calls, the plus one and MP fold. The hijack raises to $20, which is a standard raise. This player is tight and aggressive, but doesn't know when to pump the brakes. He's up 150 and sits with around 1150. The cutoff folds, and we're on the button with around 750, down 250, and the ace of spades, 10 of spades. I like this hand, but looking back, I think this is a raise or fold situation. The hijack could be trying to steal, but that goes against his style a bit. We ultimately decide to call. The small blind, big blind, and under the gun all fold. There's roughly $50 in the pot, and the flop is the queen of clubs, 10 of hearts, 10 of diamonds. The hijack leads out for $35. This is a great flop. We are only losing to queen-queen and queen-10, and I don't think this player would have raised with queen-10. We're beating almost his entire range. I'm not too concerned with much, so we decide to slow play and let him hang himself. We call. There's now 120 in the pot, and the turn is the queen of diamonds. The hijack leads again for 100. Okay, not the greatest card. We are now losing to queen-queen, ace-queen, and king-queen, but we're still ahead of aces, kings, jacks, and ace-king, as well as other pairs. I don't want to raise, but I think I can make another call. There's now 320 in the pot, and the river is the 9 of clubs. Our opponent now leads out for 300. So, if we call and lose, that leaves us with 300, down big on the night. If we call and win, we're in the positive for the night. What's the move?
Call me skittish, but doesn't it seem like a queen that caught up to us here? At the very least, we need to respect that possibility. Another gut check decision that needs to be made after we stare into the soul of our opponent. But I do believe most players would call here. Parents too, but most players.
Well, I'll be most players and I'll call. I feel like I think we're ahead. It's one of those weird situations that I think we'll find out here in a minute. But I'm going to call. So here comes part two.
Hello again. This feels like a scared pair or something like an ace-king. If we raise, could we get an ace to call thinking we're chopping or making a move? I think we might be able to, but I don't have the guts to pull that trigger. We announce call, and our opponent tables the ace of clubs, king of hearts. Ship it! Until next time, I'm Malcolm O'Malley saying, sometimes the Cosenza outdraws Big Slick. I hope to see you on the felt.
Well, I'll admit that I don't always see this possibility, a double-paired board with an ace in a hand, as an opponent as often as I do when I hold the ace. So, nice job sniffing it out, Mal.
I always wonder if they have an ace kicker in their hand when a double pairs. I always think that when they bet. I always do. And a lot of times, the story doesn't add up that they have one of those two cards, you know, and that it has to be an ace. I can't tell you how many times, especially in a cash game, I've caught somebody doing that. Raising preflop, and then the board comes 2-2, you know, deuce-deuce 7, and then it turns a 7, and he's betting out. And I'm like, okay, either you've got a pair bigger than deuces, or you're just bluffing with an ace in your hand, and then you call and your pair of trays win, you know, and it happens all the time. So I like the way you sniffed it out. I thought for sure we were ahead, and it just felt like this guy was trying to steal it with a 2-pair better kicker. I see it all the time. It's weird that you didn't think about that.
No, it's definitely a weakness that I notice I've had. You know, when I'm in that situation with the ace, I am that guy that does that bet, you know, that 7 comes, because, you know, if I'm not up against the deuce or a 7 or another pair, then I'm good to go. So, I mean, my kicker doesn't matter anymore at that point.
Yeah.
But I don't always think of it from that way, and particularly not in the situation he has here where you flop trips and then the board gets scary after that. But again, that's the psychology of poker, right? That, you know, once you flop big and then something catches up, then you start to think about somebody else having something better at that time rather than what other hands make sense there.
So. Yeah. All right,
it's time for the AdvancedPokerTraining.com Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast at AntiUpMagazine.com. If you haven't won something from us in the past year, you'll get a free membership to Advanced Poker Training, the world's number one poker training site. John Urban's back, Chris, and he's got four hands for us. So for the next month, it'll be the John Urban Hand of the Week show. So let's see where he's at. He says these hands were part of a five-hour, 1-3 no-limit hold-up session that he played at his local Maryland casino in a plexiglass wonderland.
Nice.
The table sat up to 8 players.
Okay.
All right, this week's hand. He says the table is very loose, and they tend to overvalue their hands. The villain in this hand is also very loose and has shown he is willing to bluff. He's been running very well. I start the hand with 540, and the villain has me covered. My image is fairly tight at this point. Under the gun plus one, both limp, and we are in the hijack with the queen of hearts, jack of clubs.
Okay, so, I mean, we're perceived as tight. So, if you're in the hijack and you're playing hold'em, you know, on another level, this is the type of time where type of hand or a moment when you should raise, get those limpers out, try to isolate and steal the position here, you know, get the cutoff and maybe the button to fold if you can. Normally, if I'm playing in one of those, you know, we talk about this often too. If I'm up a bunch of money, I like to speculate and just limp along for a couple of bucks here and there, you know, just to try to make hands that no one puts me on, and then they get sucked in because they think they're making a possibility and I've already made a great hand. So sometimes I'll limp with this. But if you're playing properly and you're in the hijacks or you're close enough to steal position and you don't want those looky-loos hanging around either, you might want to just make a nice little raise here. So if it was, you know, 1-3, generally you're making it 9 or 10 to go. If there's two limpers, you've got 6 more bucks there to make it. So, you know, something like $15 to $20 might be a proper raise here. And then you have that tight, aggressive image already, so they could put you on a big hand with that raise, and you know, you could shock them with your, you know, you turn over two pair of queens and jacks or something like that. So I think I like a raise here. Other than that, I probably would fold. So I'm probably gonna raise here, you know, like I said, to like what, 15-20?
Yeah, so this is the ongoing debate on how you play in a very loose game. I think conventional wisdom is that you tighten up. And when you get your good hands, you know you're going to get paid off on them versus not. The other way is to loosen up and jump in the pool and splash around with them, right? But you want to make them pay for that. So the fact that we got a couple limpers here, the way he's got this game set up, I'm not too worried about those limpers having big hands and, you know, doing that limp re-raise. So I went fewer looser players in the hand with a hand like this. So I would raise at that point. So to me, I think it's a raise or fold. I don't think I'm
going to. Holy cow. We totally agreed. Yeah. All right, good.
All right. Our hero says very rarely. Wow.
Hard to say.
I always say that 2 times and I didn't say it fast at all. I very rarely pre-flop since it's easy to exploit and caps my range, but with this hand and position on several loose opponents, I could easily have them dominated right now. Excuse me. If I raise and I'm called, it's likely me who becomes dominated. With position and straight potential, I like a limp here, so I call.
Well, there's a way to rationalize every hand, really. Sure. I mean, especially at a loose table. So I have no problem with that. It's just that you really want position. I wouldn't mind just doing raise and take it here, or, you know, raise and c-bet and take it. You know, that happens a lot in poker. You don't have to know your 2 cards to do that. So I don't disagree with his analysis of what the situation right now. But to me, I think optimally you want to raise.
All right. Let's see. The small blind and big blind also limp. So 5 players of the flop, $15 in the pot. The flop is the 9 of diamonds, 8 of clubs, tray of clubs, and it checks to us.
See, now this is why. Because initially, if you had raised, now you'd be taking control of the hand, and they could put you on an overpair to the 9s and be done with it. So now you have 2 overs and a gutter, which is great, and backdoor clubs to the jack high flush, which is not really great. But if you had taken control of the hand, they might respect the c-bet here and fold out of the way, or they might have gotten out of the way earlier and not been able to hit these crap cards that are on the board. So the blinds that limped now can totally be, you know, with a made hand. So this is why you raise. Now, of course, you do have a decent hand here. You have a gutter and 2 overs, so you could raise. You could bet right now and take it. Who knows? I don't want to play for such a small pot, so I think I would want to put some money in the pot. Since we have position, you know, it's hard to imagine us being like re-raise now. I don't think someone's going to check flop or, you know, check flop as raise us, but
If that's going to happen, I'd rather it happen for $10.
Yes. So great point. So let's bet.
It's more of a probing bet for me now. I mean, we got a hand, as you mentioned, a 10 comes would be fantastic for us. Queen or Jack might even win it for us. And, you know, we got those running clubs maybe. But at this point, I just want to snuff out what these limpers behind me have. Make sure that no one's sitting on 9-8 or 9-tray or 8-tray or something weird like that, right?
So, yes.
So I want to bet now and see if I get raised, and that's an easy fold for me. But I would rather to get some of these wannabes out of his hand. And if I could end up winning this pot without improving, that would be fantastic.
Yes.
All right, here it says, this is an easy bet. I have a lot of equity here against a one-pair hand, and doesn't look like anyone even has that, or at best, a middle pair of eights. And with position, I should get many bluff cards on the turn or river to steal it. I bet $10. That's a good point about the bluff cards, too. Ace, king, anything like that, you can continue to bet with somewhat confidence, if it continues to check to you. So.
But especially if you had raised preflop. Right now, if you limped, why would you have limped with ace, king or something? You know what I mean? So it's tough to sell that you have an ace when you didn't play it strong before the flop. That's the story. We always talk about the story. So I agree that, yeah, you could try to represent it, but they may not believe you because you didn't play it strongly preflop.
All right, let's see. So we bet $10, the small blind, and under the gun plus one call. Pot is $40 after the rake. And the turn is the queen of spades. So our board now is nine of diamonds, eight of clubs, tray of clubs, queen of spades. And once again, it checks to us.
Okay, well, now we, we're still pretty decent. I mean, Jack 10 is obviously a hand everyone loves to play, and we're screwed. But it's a good turn card for us if they didn't have Jack 10. If they had Jack 10, I felt like they might have bet, but they also could be doing the same thing where, they're disguising the strength of their hand. I don't know.
I guess I'm less worried about Jack 10 because, I mean, if it was a raised pot, then, yeah, you might want to let that person continue to hang themselves with that good draw. But otherwise, if I have Jack in a limp pot with Jack 10, I'm betting at any of these spots, small blind, big blind, whatever.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I know that's the concern we should have, that Jack 10 might be out there. But I'm going to minimize that. Just the way that this hand has come down. Now, I could be surprised later on. But
so, you'd probably bet $20 then, right?
Yeah. It wasn't the card I was hoping for, but it's a card that improved us. And I think that the death knell of the Jack 10, I just don't think is there. So, yeah, I'm going to keep betting. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, here it says, now I have a value hand and no one has shown any strength yet. My opponents seem to have very weak hands, such as third pair or a gut shot, so I don't think I need a big bet here. Even with a half pot bet, I wouldn't be giving them good odds to call, so I bet $20. All right.
Oh, man.
Exactly what we thought. All right, only the under the gun plus one call. So we're heads up now. Pot is $80. The river is the Jack of Diamonds. So our final board is nine of diamonds, eight of clubs, tray of clubs, queen of spades, jack of diamonds, and our opponent checks to us one last time.
Check. Check. I mean, there's no reason not to check now. Any 10 beats you. You still could lose to a baby set. I know you want your value for your two pair, but you've got an $80 pot. There's no reason to walk away from that hand saying, oh, I missed. No, you made a decent amount of money by limping in and making this hand. And if you lose, you mitigate your losses. I don't see any reason to bet and watch this guy check raise me. He's already got us covered in a 1-3 game, which means he has over $550, which means he's playing it pretty well. And you've taken control of this hand, and he's letting you, he's walking the dog. He's letting you take the betting for him. I don't see any reason to do a value bet here. It's a big enough pot. It's a bad turn card for us. If it was a deuce or something, a red deuce, then you're like, okay, you know what? I feel free to bet. Now, anyone who's drawing, you can go back in time if you want. If somebody has any 10, what if they had 9-10 or 8-10? And so 9-10 probably doesn't work because I probably would have bet top pair with a limp pot. But let's say they had ace-10 and they didn't think it was worthy of raising out of position. So they're in the blinds or blind plus, under the gun plus one or whatever. So they limped with it. And it was a suited ace-10 or something. Who knows? Any 10 now could have played this hand exactly the way they did. They limp in because it's not a great 10. The flop comes, it's really kind of, but it's got a pair, like maybe it's, you know, 8-10, like I said, you got a middle pair and you got a backdoor, whatever. Now the queen comes, it's still a gutter, so you're not really putting any kind of hope in a draw. You know, you're like, I still got to hit the gutter here. But it's only a $10 bet, and then it's a $20 bet. So it's like, I just don't see any reason to bet here. I don't see getting value, because you're only going to get called or raised by a better hand. So any hand that has less than two pair is not going to call your bet. I just check behind.
There might be a case that a weaker queen might call, but that's about the only thing I can think of. So I'm on Team Cosenza here. I'm just going to check, be happy with his $80 pot. And if for some reason he did catch up with a 10 or had us beat all along for whatever reason, then I've saved some money. So
the only queen that I can see that's even available out there for us to beat is King Queen. And that may have raised preflop, because, or Ace Queen would have raised. King Queen maybe would have raised, but there is no Queen 10. That beats us. Queen Jack's the same. Queen 9 is two pair. They would have had top pair. They would have bet it. So Queen 8, they would have had two pair. So I don't see any queen other than King Queen or Ace Queen, and I think those two hands probably raise in such a loose hand, loose game. So I feel like we're beat. I feel like there's a 10, and we need to check behind.
All right. Here it says, the board looks scary, but my opponent could have a number of worse two-pair combinations or simply bluff catcher that might want to look me up thinking I missed a flush. While I opened myself up to a bluff check raise, I didn't think it was likely my opponent had that move, especially since I could easily have a 10. So I think a bet is in order with a plan to fold to a check raise. I thought there were a lot more one-pair hands in his range that he might be able to talk himself into a call for the right price. So I like a smaller bet here. I bet $30.
Well, you know, we've talked about the amount that you bet on the river is usually a third. So he's a little more than a third. So I don't think that's a small bet. I think that's the right size bet you usually make when you're looking for value. I'd have bet 25, but I'm scared now.
Yeah. Well, and our opponent raises to 120.
Yeah. And so he could be bluffing, because he probably doesn't think you have a 10 by the way you played it. But to me, now I just wasted $30, because I don't think I have the stones to call now. So I think I would fold now.
I mean, it's a really good play, regardless of whether he has a 10 or not, right? Because we didn't play it like we had a 10. And then even you look at the psychology. I mean, our hero says, well, I open myself up to a bluff check raise, and I'm planning to fold to that, right?
Yeah.
So already in your mind, you're like, hey, I'm going to bet $30, and if I get raised, I'm going to fold this thing. So if you know your opponent's going to do that, then you should raise every single time.
Yeah.
And sometimes he's going to have it, but more times than not, he's not.
Yeah.
And, I think that's the case here. This guy just outplayed us, I think. But, and if we had just checked behind, then we would know for sure.
Okay.
I can't call this, I don't think.
I'm folding.
All right. Our hero says, dope. Said earlier, I was planning on folding here, but I took a moment to examine his body language since he was sitting right next to me. He seemed to be squirming a little, but his squirming seemed forced. It looked like fake tells to me, which made me think he had it. I fold. He later mentioned to me that he did have a 10 for a straight. Well, that's what I would have told you, too. So,
yeah.
I'm not saying your opponent's a liar there, but I definitely want you to think that I had it there. Because that's just going to allow you to continue to make that move on you all night long.
Yeah. Yep. And like I said, very few hands are going to call a $30 bet there that you beat. Because really, he's talking about worst two pair. Nobody is playing. Nobody. I don't think anyone's really limping with Queen 9. They might have limped with 9-8, but they're betting that 9-8 way earlier than your call on the end. The club draws, no one's calling if they miss their draw. So I don't see two pair that beat you, and Scott and I came up with reasons why a random queen wouldn't have come alive earlier. So to me, I just, that bet, you could have checked, called for $30, because he probably would have made a value bet of 30 instead of raising you to 120, you know, and then you would have had your answer and bet the same amount of money. You would have lost the same amount of money. To me, I just check at the end and call a reasonable bet or fold. I just can't.
Yeah. Pit them. And the other thing is the two pairs don't make sense with the position of our player. He's under the gun plus one. Now, I know this game has been described as very loose, so I don't know how very, very loose is. But, I mean, now you're talking queen nine, queen eight, queen tray. I just don't see those limping under the gun plus one, even in a very loose game. So
right. And so let's imagine it is the
Jack nine, Jack
Jack ten,
Jack trick, Jack, you know, 9-8, 9-8. I mean, they would have flopped two pair. We would have heard from earlier, I think. So
yeah,
I don't think there were any two pair hands that were realistic there.
No, it feels like he had Jack 10 or 8-10, you know, under the gun, whatever, plus one or whatever it was. It's tough to imagine 8-10 limping, but if it's really loose, he could. But Jack 10 fits this hand. I know, you know, not everyone always bets their four-card draw. You know what I mean? Not everybody bets their open-enders when the flop comes in their out of position. A lot of people check to see what's going to happen and maybe check raise later or maybe see if there's enough pot odds, more callers. Not everyone is so bold like we are to bet Jack 10 there. So when the turn gets there, now he's like, okay, now I've got it. Why would I bet? This guy's willing to bet, and there's other people in the hand. Let's let him bet. And so he did. They checked to him. We bet 20. We called, and then the other guy folded. So, okay, well, now I've got the made hand. We know this guy bets. Now the jack comes, and you're like, all right, well, my straight is kind of compromised, but I still have my straight. Let me check this guy one last time, see if he'll bet. And we did, you know, because I felt like if he checked, if we had bet, he probably couldn't make that call anyway, our you know, our hands. So I think the guy probably had Jack 10 or even Ace 10, you know, something like that. So I don't know, Ace 10 with the Ace of Clubs, you know, something like that. But yeah, I think we were beaten. We should have checked behind. But we'll see if John's play gets turned around in the next couple of weeks, because he's got three more hands with us. So all right, I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the table.
Anti-Up is a production of antiupmagazine.com. Contact the show at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. If you'd like to advertise, send an email to advertising@antiupmagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.